Hello, I'm Mike Watson, joined by Sarah Lee, and this is the Influence Watch podcast. Wind power sounds lovely. Supposedly free, indeed infinite, renewable, clean energy from the predictable patterns of moving air. Except it isn't quite so simple. Turbines catch fire with disquieting frequency. The amount of land needed to produce electricity is quite high. And then there's the political protection racket keeping even clean generating rivals out of the market and wind generators on the government dole. Here to explain is our colleague Ken Braun, who follows energy and environmental issues for Capital Research Center. Ken, welcome back.
Always happy to be here.
So what's going on with the wind energy industry that you've been following?
Loads and loads of cash flying at them at, you know, a furious pace. The Inflation Reduction Act passed by the Biden administration, approved by Congress, obviously, a minimum $400 billion will flow to the weather-restricted power industry and other types of climate pork. Goldman Sachs has estimated that could be as high as $1.2 trillion because of some of these things not being capped. And, I mean, we can get into all of the issues you just discussed about the reliability and the land use and the efficiency of these things. But it's interesting to note also that the subsidies flying into the industry from one end are also going out in subsidies to the climate nonprofits that promote weather-dependent energy and in many cases oppose nuclear energy. Vestas, one of the biggest wind turbine makers, has given, you know, hundreds of thousands at least to Friends of the Earth, the Rocky Mountain Institute. Berkshire Hathaway Energy, Warren Buffett's, Berkshire Hathaway's weather-dependent energy developer is on the hook, has, you know, Rocky Mountain Institute has reported over $1 million one year in one of their annual reports. And that's
just,
not...
Just as a brief, name the players. Who are Rocky Mountain Institute and Friends of the Earth and any other of the big players in the renewable advocacy?
Wow. Yeah. So the renewable advocacy goes in, you know, what I call weather restricted energy advocacy. Wind and solar is almost exclusively what we're talking about. Almost every single one of the climate nonprofits, the big ones, are heavily supportive of this industry and oppose nuclear power. We're talking, you know, Rocky Mountain Institute is a newer and larger player hitting, you know, over $100 million in annual revenue.
But our listeners might know them as the people behind the attempt to ban gas stoves. Yes.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They were the star player in that. But they are inching their way up with big donations to join the ranks of the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Sierra Club, the Environmental Defense Fund. These are the League of Conservation Voters. Those are pretty much the big four or five. Six, whatever I named there, and then there are, you know, smaller ones. You can go down the line. But those are the big ones. And I should note, it's as far as corporate donations, which is a lot of what we're going to be discussing here. What I just discussed, these are not really always trackable. They don't have to report who their corporate donors are. And you know, donor privacy is an important defensible policy. But Rocky Mountain, for whatever their reasons are, do report a lot of them, even though they have a growing number of anonymous donations. And that's how we know about the donations of Vestas and Berkshire Hathaway.
Sarah, do you have any?
Yeah, sure. Hey, Ken, thanks for coming back on. Always good to see you. We see you a lot, but it's always good to see you here. I guess what I'm mostly curious about, we haven't gotten into the corporate donations yet, and I know we will, and that's the subsidies going out the other side, right, to the nonprofits, mm-hmm. just to clarify. And what those nonprofits, you are telling us that there's a huge overlap between within those nonprofits' activism between sort of just general environmental causes and just straight up anti-nuclear, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So just for our listeners, why do they oppose nuclear power? I know you, and I'm sure you'll say this. I don't think I'm telling secrets out of school. You are a big proponent of nuclear power. So what's their problem with it?
So just to back up a little bit there, I think no form of energy should get massive subsidies. Nuclear gets less than most others, which, in a way that I think we should cover in a moment here. But if you're going to reduce carbon emissions, there is simply no way to do it efficiently without nuclear power.
Okay.
And nuclear energy is the most efficient means of, by you know, little tiny, a can of Coke full of uranium will power Sarah's entire life.
Just ask the friend who did this 40 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, nuclear energy is such a dense power source that it would probably be the most efficient energy source we have right now if we had not stopped developing it, largely because of the groups that I just mentioned and what I tallied up as I think it was $2.3 billion.
Let's not let Jane Fonda off the hook.
Yes.
Wasn't she in that movie?
Yes. The China.
China Syndrome?
China Syndrome. Thank you.
So yeah, what is their problem with nuclear power? Is it the...
Well,
and I bring up Fonda because Fonda is a giant environmentalist now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, their problem, I mean, they believe a whole lot of myths about the safety of nuclear energy and the waste disposal and all of these things. But I think the likely anonymous donations that a lot of them are getting from the weather dependent power industry is another factor. Like I said, we can see some of this happening, but I think you just follow the money and can come up to a lot of conclusions there. I added up all of the annual revenues of these groups from their most recent tax filings and came up with $2.3 billion in collected revenue from, I think, 200 and some odd anti-nuclear climate and left-leaning NGOs.
Our listeners can go to Influence Watch. We have, I believe it's Opposition to Nuclear Energy is the title we ended up putting it.
That is the title to it, and it references the report that I did. But yeah, I systemized it in that particular profile, so all of the groups are listed there. And if you're one of those groups and you'd like to get off the list, we'd love to take you off the list and announce that you've come to your senses. We'll send a news release out.
Well, given that, you know, their problem is with the safety, you know, this last four-parter that you wrote, which I just finished, you know, rereading before this podcast, it's all about the safety of these wind turbines, right? And Vestas, these blades go flying off into people's farmland. So
yeah.
How do you square those two things? You know, we're afraid of the nuclear, you know, safety problems, and yet you've got all of these examples of this problems in the wind industry.
Right. Just as if you do it on a per amount of energy produced basis, nothing is safer than nuclear energy. The wind and solar are comparably close as far as injuries. The litany of blade throws and fires and tower collapses that I've been profiling in all of these items, generally don't harm anyone. There are some rare exceptions. But what's interesting is how many malfunctions they have for the, you know, the tiny trickles of power that they create, and the claims that, you know,
give our listeners an idea of how much power a wind turbine creates versus if you prefer a standard power plant or a nuclear power plant, and what those numbers mean.
So soon to come out in a forthcoming profile of General Electric's wind turbines. Vaclav Smil, he's a professor at, I think he's Canadian, calculated sometime back just basic physics, how much wind blows and how many how much you can actually collect from a turbine, calculated that you would need to cover a land mass two times the size of California in order to power the entire nation with wind turbines.
I mean, that sounds like a perfect excuse for, grabbing people's land and
Well, and consider this. I mean, the industry will claim, well, that's old. You know, we're getting better all the time. Okay, that's great. January 2024, GE announced with a project with Pattern Energy to build in New Mexico on nearly 1,600 square miles of New Mexico, the largest renewable energy project in the history of the Western Hemisphere. Okay, 1,600 square miles of this thing, 674 of GE's brand new turbines. This is going to be 1,600 square miles. Grand Canyon National Park, is which you can see from space, is 1,900 square miles. And that's the whole park. The canyon itself is, you know, much. So this wind is bigger than the Grand Canyon in all likelihood. The Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant, which sits about 60 miles from Phoenix, produces, even with all of that landmass, Palo Verde will produce four times the electricity every year as this biggest wind turbine field in the history of the Western Hemisphere, and it'll do it from 6.4 square miles, pretty much a large subdivision, right?
Are you saying that we should be taking efficiency into consideration, Ken?
Well, we should definitely be taking efficiency into consideration. I mean, think about this. This isn't even built yet. It's the latest and greatest turbines that GE's ever built on the biggest wind turbine field in the history of the United States, and it's one 255th or whatever of the land use. For four times the energy. This is literally close to 1,000 times more efficient to build a nuclear power plant on the same land.
So now I'm going to raise your blood pressure even more. How much is the government spending? How much is the government spending on what frankly sounds like a boondoggle?
So Robert Bryce, the energy journalist, calculated this out using the Department of Energy Information Agency's data. We are right now, just on a per BTU basis, amount of energy produced, you know, apples to apples comparison, wind energy is receiving 31 times the subsidies of oil and gas and 70x what nuclear receives.
That's
70 times what nuclear receives. So if you want, like I said, if you want carbon reductions and you want to use tax dollars to do it, you are burning the money up and creating who knows how many carbon emissions with the burning cash by giving it to wind and solar. Solar is even worse. That's 132 times oil and gas and a stunning 302 times nuclear for the same amount of energy. The best quote on this ever was said way back in 2014 by Warren Buffett himself, one of the nation's, you know, premier builders of wind turbine facilities, and has been for the last 10 years since he said this. They've built even more since. He said, "We get a tax credit if we build a lot of wind farms. That's the only reason to build them. They don't make sense without the tax credit." Vestas, the wind turbine maker, 2 years before this testified to Congress that 75% to 95% of the American wind industry would vanish without the wind production tax credit, which has been re-upped and turbocharged with the Inflation Reduction Act.
Why are we giving Warren Buffett's companies a tax credit for this?
Well, that's because my question too. Like, I realize the government is notoriously, it's known for making stupid decisions. This one seems extraordinarily stupid to give that much subsidy, that much money to subsidize that industry that much.
I say this to not
do a good job.
As a hobbyist history buff on this particular subject, I think as a policy matter, our wind and solar subsidies may be the dumbest thing this country has done since the Vietnam War.
It's certainly up there, because especially when, you know, that statistic you cited, that it gets, what did you say, 30 times, solar gets, wait, per BTU,
solar,
wind gets 31 times the amount of subsidies, is that right?
That oil... Wind receives 31x, 31 times the subsidies of oil and gas, and 70 times that of nuclear. And then solar, you can more or less multiply those numbers by 6, 132 times oil and gas and 302 times nuclear.
For an industry that is still largely experimental, is still largely not really productive or, you know, efficient, it's insane.
Yeah, I think put together, I'd have to check the numbers, but wind and solar's contribution to our electric grid is still well under 10%. It might be combined like 8-point-something% total.
And my understanding is those percentages come with a giant drawback too.
Definitely.
The intermittency is a problem.
The intermittency is a major problem because if you're building an electric grid, the most important thing you want to pay for is reliability. And after that, you want affordability. And then after that, you start thinking, okay, safety, carbon emissions, all these other, whatever policy concerns you have after that. Wind farms, solar farms are the opposite of reliable. So if you're buying those, you are buying something that's already going to compromise your grid. And the more you put on them, the more you compromise it. Because, you know, you think about anything, if you add less reliability into the system, you're going to create more disruptions. You've got to do a whole lot more planning. You have to build backups of reliable stuff, solar natural gas.
That's partly what makes them reliable, is that they have
right.
backups.
Right. Now there's other things that, like, there's reasons natural gas cannot be reliable because we have to use it for heating fuel as well. And when you have a major weather event, people that need to heat their homes and electricity, you can end up with natural gas plants being denied, become less reliable. But the increases of solar and wind on systems is making our electric grids more and less reliable, and in some cases dangerously so. I would advise anyone who's concerned about this to watch Robert Bryce's documentary on YouTube called Juice, Power Politics in the Grid, and in it they point out a bunch of the problems with this, but one of the more important ones was done by the Federal Energy Reliability Commission, FERC.
Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Regulatory Commission. Thank you. I wanted to put the reliability in there.
FERC.
Yeah, FERC.
FERC. FERC it.
Yes. So because of and what's happened a lot when we put more and more wind and solar on our electric grids, and there's multiple grids in the nation, is we've retired coal plants, which are extremely reliable. The big mountains of coal sit there and burn whether the weather is bad or not. And nuclear plants, which are also extremely reliable because both of them hold their power on site. So FERC recently did a report that the Mid-Continent Independent Systems Operator, MISO, MISO grid, which is the one I live in, it basically runs from Minnesota to Michigan and then down the Mississippi River to Louisiana. That grid is in danger of is now, because of these adding all of these instabilities into the system, is in danger of blackouts even under normal peak demand. That means that they've somehow managed to make this grid less reliable than California's. An impressive job.
So how, we've discussed how much of the wind welfare there is. How are the companies using the environmentalist movement to keep competitors, even clean competitors like nuclear, out of the market?
Well, they're getting more subsidies to begin with, and once you're getting paid more, you can do that. But like I said, we've got $2.3 billion in annual revenue flowing to these nonprofits, these left-leaning climate nonprofits, who are, you know, coming. The way I found a lot of these was that these groups had these positions was from letters that they had co-signed to Congress, calling nuclear power dirty energy, calling it dangerous, calling it, you know, all of the things that it's not, and, you know, scaring people into, basically selling nuclear energy like they're the opening credits of The Simpsons, and convincing us all that Homer is the guy that's running these things, and if we have more of this, there'll be more people walking out of the plant with, you know, glowing fuel rods stuck in the back of their shirt. And that's more or less the image that they try and sell with it, and why we don't have more quote-unquote clean nuclear energy and have a lot of these wind turbines, unreliable wind and solar systems going up.
To what extent on the environmentalist advocacy group side do you think that, so there's kind of the joke that, the supposition that environmentalist groups are more interested in, let's be charitable and call it transformative social change than whatever their stated reducing pollution, reducing carbon emissions.
I cannot believe you're not going to say everything leftism. I cannot believe you just decided against that term. You say that all the time. Sorry.
Yes. The they're more interested in everything leftism than they're, and that nuclear power presents a problem to the, I'm going to use the climate to achieve everything leftism because it solves the problem without transformative social change. To what extent do you think that that's a motivating factor versus sort of more cynical?
Great work on this has been done by Michael Schellenberger, but it goes back to the anti-human inclination that we've just got too many damn people on the planet. The guy's name is escaping me right now, but the founder, Amory Lovins, the founder of the aforementioned Rocky Mountain Institute, said something way back in the 70s to the effect of, you know, we can't have, even if we had clean, efficient, you know, non-polluting, limitless nuclear energy, he would still be opposed to it because of the fear of what we might do with limitless energy. And that goes straight to the fact, you know, too much of an economy and wealth and human progress is considered, you know, somewhat of a danger, or people are the pollution is I think the general attitude there. And you can see this in the attitude of a lot of these groups toward other energy systems when they become viable. There was a time when natural gas was not so plentiful in this country.
I remember this, the Sierra Club. In fact, they took, I believe at one point, they took money from a natural gas energy company to go after coal. And
yes.
Then natural gas got cheap.
They wanted to get beyond coal, and now they're, you know, yeah, are we going to get beyond natural gas as well? I mean, there was, yeah, and even before that, there was a time when it was promoted as clean burning fuel, but now it's not because it's actually becoming functionally limitless as far as our economy goes now.
We keep finding more of it.
Yes, and... The Sierra Club began as a pro-nuclear organization.
Because
Ansel
it was clean.
Adams, I think, was...
Yeah, because
was,
it was clean energy?
Yeah, and then flipped on it in the 1970s as well with... You know, a lot of roads lead back to Amory Lovins if you read Michael Schellenberger's take on the story. But yeah, it's an opposition to people on the planet and the pollution of humanity and its striving for wealth and prosperity is what I think animates a lot of the movement historically and still today.
And I'll say this too, I'd add to that and just say this is a little more philosophical probably than we want to be, but that side of things, that sort of, you know, that sort of leftist activist side, they tend to run on fear, right? Everything's going to kill you. Everything's dangerous. Here's what's wrong with everything. And so to the extent that that can be monetized,
yeah,
I think is a huge part of it.
It's really easy to demonize technology and especially something as complex as a nuclear reactor and nuclear physics. You know, Hollywood does it. I mentioned The Simpsons. I mean, you look at, I mean, fear sells a lot better than hope and prosperity does. Look at the AI thing. I mean, you can find The Terminator and Battlestar Galactica and all, you know, blah, blah. I was just thinking about this the other day. I grew up as a kid. One of my favorite shows was The $6 Million Man, right? Was it pro-technology? Well, that's good because that was a hopeful, you know, technology can enhance human production and you know that kind of thing. But it's really, you know, the wind, you know, the idea that just pleasant breezes and sunshine can power our world is their idea of hope. And technology is easy to demonize as scary, and you obviously need more technology to pull up oil and gas and create, you know, uranium and the like of that. Yeah.
Sarah, before we let Ken go, anything else from you?
Yeah, actually, I do have a question. It's tied to something, Mike, that you sent into our chat room earlier today. I think it was you, about the sort of falling out of love with EVs, right? That's a lot of the car manufacturers are like, you know what, this isn't really working, so we're going to scale back our plans to go forward with electric vehicles. Do you see anything similar to that happening in the alternative energy industry? I think the research and development of that industry is fantastic, but I think trying to roll it out before it's ready, same with electric vehicles, has always been the problem. So do you see anything similar happening in the wind industry or solar industry?
I think it's a hypothetical industry at this point, because there's only so much efficiency you can squeeze out. I mean, the sun has a certain number of watts per meter square that hits the earth, right? And from everything I've read, the solar panels are hitting that limit as to what they're capturing. You can't make a solar panel more efficient unless you can somehow make the sun shine brighter. Mm-hmm. Similar problems are afflicting wind energy. The accidents that we didn't really get to that are happening are in an effort to just create more and more efficient wind turbines. Well, there's only so much you're going to get. So no, I don't think that it's ever going to get any better as far as its efficiency goes. And on the other side, there's a growing opposition to siting these things local. You know, people don't like living near them for all sorts of reasons that are understandable.
And there's, to the extent there isn't the same sort of pushback that we've seen to electric vehicles, I think it's about who's buying and who's building. Because who's buying, you know, who is the customer for a car company? It's individual families.
That's a good point.
Who have a need, and if an electric car supplies only 80% of the need for 150% the cost, they're not going to buy it.
Yeah. Not a lot of individual customers have 1,600 square miles of land to put up a wind field on.
Right, right. Yeah. A utility company can just go subsidy chasing as long as it takes until they have some sort of catastrophic grid failure, which hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, before I let you go, anything else you'd like to promote?
Sarah touched on briefly the land use concerns and the failure rates of these turbines. As I said, it's important to look at them not on how often they fail, but how often they fail for how little energy they produce. But even with that, all the big wind turbine makers last year were admitting to hundreds of millions of dollars in unanticipated costs to fix failing turbines, you know, towers collapsing and things. The industry finally admitted that it had a problem. But something I've been doing with a whole lot of these profiles of both the developer, the companies that develop the facilities, and the wind turbine makers is just listing the number of failures that I can find. And this is my favorite example, but there's many of them. If you Google any wind operation and rare, the word rare, exceedingly rare, rare incident, whatever, you'll find hilarious repetitions of the same statement after different calamities. So here's my favorite one involving NextEra. It's a Florida-based company that develops wind turbine fields. June 2017, the Des Moines Register showed a video of a NextEra wind turbine belching black smoke as it burned in somewhere in Iowa. The NextEra spokesman responded this, saying this was exceedingly rare, and he could not, quote, recall the last time one of these situations has happened. Less than a week later, also in June 2017, a 426-foot NextEra-owned tower collapsed in Nebraska. Same guy pronounces the tower collapse very rare. 2 weeks after that, we're still in June 2017, a blade destroyed itself in a NextEra wind turbine in Michigan. Same spokesman comes back onto the site, and according to the AP, he says such breaks are rare. If you read all of the stuff that I've been working on these, you will see many different instances of the rare and exceedingly rare incidents happening over and over again. Sometimes in one case, I can't remember which one it was, the same tower failed twice. The tower collapsed. The tower collapsed, they replaced it, and then the new tower, like 2 years later, the turbine lit on fire or vice versa, or threw a blade or whatever. I mean, the number of coincidental calamities that are very rare are a fun little side bet on these that I've been doing, and I think they're going to get worse because of the number of turbines that we're throwing up.
They're getting older.
And they're getting older.
Every mechanical device has a lifespan.
Yeah, interestingly enough, on that point, and we can probably close on this, the aforementioned giant greatest wind turbine field, largest wind turbine field in the history of the Western Hemisphere, that's going up in New Mexico, like a week after GE announced it, not even a week, later in January 2024, one of their turbines in I believe it was in Colorado collapsed. So they couldn't even go a week after announcing that they were going to put up the newest, latest, and greatest turbines, and then one in Colorado, just north of where they were talking about 500 miles, fell over, and that one had only been up for 9 years. So.
Well, clearly they need subsidies to get things back online.
They do, because I told myself I wouldn't do this, but the greatest analysis of wind turbines, the greatest quote I've found so far, is an anonymous one for reasons that will probably become clear in a moment. The anonymous curmudgeon said that wind turbines are like strippers. They only work if you throw money at them.
So. Yes!
Well, thanks again to Ken Braun for joining us. We will include some of his writing on the wind energy industry and its influence connections in today's show notes. That's our show for this week. We encourage our listeners to subscribe on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And if you have subscribed, thank you. Please leave us a 5-star rating. Those readings really help us find new listeners, especially if they come with a positive review. We'll see you all next week.